Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagn Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us to discuss a very big week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, joining us from the sidelines of a fencing tournament in sunny Colorado. Right, Ron? Have I got that right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Great. I'm glad to be here, Vagn.
And how are the kids doing?
Yeah, they're doing great. They're doing great.
Fantastic. Joining us also is Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in what is now a less sunny than was over the weekend, London. Sash, welcome back.
Thank you very much indeed, Vagn.
Okay, so as our audience knows, we have been tracking the fate of the A380 since the inception of this show. We forecasted that the program was likely to end, and all of us have covered the program actually since its very inception. And Airbus CEO Tom Enders finally ripped off the Band-Aid. Sash, you were there. What was his message, and what was the reaction?
I'll do that in reverse. The reaction was muted. I think that this was an event that, you know, a lot of people had seen coming. It's clearly very sad. You know, aircraft programs dying is not something any of us relish. But this was Tom Enders doing what he does best. He was being absolutely brutally realistic about the prospects, or rather the lack of prospects, for the program, and hence what Airbus has got to do for the, you know, the best interests actually of the whole company and its stakeholders going forward. You can't keep a program like this going on life support forever. It was bleeding a couple of hundred million a year, which in the scheme of things, and Airbus had really good numbers last week for fiscal 2018, but in the scheme of things, that's manageable. But it was only going to get worse. Emirates pulled the plug on the whole of it, most of the remainder of its order, and Airbus did likewise. And that's a very, very sad event.
It is sad to see an airplane program go away, especially one that was such an engineering and technological marvel. Ron, how was the news greeted on Wall Street?
Yeah, I mean, like Sash said, I mean, you know, Airbus's results were so strong. I don't think it was widely unexpected, right? You know, sadly, when an aircraft program really has one dominant customer and that customer changes its mind, I mean, the writing's on the wall. Other than that, I don't have much to add.
Do you, so what are some of the cautionary lessons, you know, from the program? I mean, there are those who maintain that the program, the A380 program, died of its own original sin of not having been as well a thought-through program as it could have been, and that the consortium developing it underestimated the challenges of developing such a large airplane. I mean, I remember visiting Airbus facilities where there was an enormous amount of engineering work going on, even after the design had been finalized, to take weight out of the program on all manner of componentry. That's a challenge, obviously, for any program. But, Sash, you and I were talking before the show, and you said, look, at the time, don't be so tough on Airbus, because it was not as clear that this mega hub to mega hub strategy was as that the era of the mega hub to mega hub strategy was over. Right at that point, we didn't see airplanes like the 787 and the A350, which is what ultimately killed the 380. Talk to us a little bit about that dynamic and what, from your standpoint, and Ron, I'd like to get your take on what the lessons from the program were.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the A380 could have been saved by shaving 30 tons of weight out of it, although that would have been a great achievement. It would have required a lot of what we normally refer to as unobtainium in the structure, and there would probably have been a cost penalty associated with that. But I didn't think it was the costs that ultimately killed the 380. If you fill the aircraft up, it works fine. The problem is the number of routes that need 550 seats in one block is very, very limited indeed. And this is where Airbus, I think, were just over-optimistic structurally. If you look at where it works best, actually it's Hong Kong, London, because the time zone is incredibly punishing in terms of when you can take off, when you can land. You need to put big aircraft on. But there aren't that many other routes. And you're absolutely right. What really killed this was longer range aircraft that can overfly the big hubs and can deliver 300 packs, probably even 250 packs, in a very, very economical way. So long range twin or longer range twin engined aircraft, 787 and then the 350. those killed the A380 in a way that the 777 wasn't quite doing, and in a way even that its costs weren't quite doing. What I think is so interesting about last week's decision is that actually we saw two things die. We saw the A380 die, but we also are seeing the Gulf carriers die. And that is a shift in the global airline industry that I think has not been properly recognized. Two things happened last week. Emirates gave up getting bigger. They gave up buying bigger and bigger and bigger aircraft. So they were going to have a fleet composed entirely of 150, 180 A380s, and then 100 plus 777Xs, where the 777X would be the baby of the fleet. Now, they started ordering smaller aircraft again. They're ordering A350s, which is definitely smaller than the 777X. They're ordering A330neos. They're downgauging, and that tells you they can't grow. And then you have Emirates cancelling 777Xs, cancelling A350s. They're just going to become a niche and, frankly, irrelevant carrier. So these big hubs in the Gulf are dying because they've got no natural hinterland. Nobody goes to the Gulf for pleasure. You go to it for business, or you go through it. If you can go across it, that wins every time. And the Gulf carriers are dead. And that means, or you know, they're dying as, you know, the force in this industry, in my view. And that's going to change the whole way that we look at what sort of aircraft people want.
Ron, your take?
Yeah, I think there's a couple interesting takeaways, right? I agree 100% with Sash. I mean, I think you got to be careful about being too hard on Airbus, right? And the point being, you know, forecasting how air traffic markets are going to evolve over time can be really difficult, right? And just to, you know, as a case in point, you know, when the 757 was first developed, I don't think anybody thought that thing would be flying across the Atlantic and being deployed in the way it is today, right? So, you know, the ways that the A380 would have been used over, you know, a potential 30-year lifespan, it's very, very hard to forecast on day one. But one lesson is, really try hard to get the, you know, that market development right. In this case, it didn't really play out, but I mean, it's hard to do. Second thing, it's a quad, right? And, you know, in today's technology and world, you just don't need quads anymore, right? And they're a bit of an anachronism. A third point to how difficult it is to forecast that market, Boeing did do the 747-8, even after saying they didn't think that, you know, that there was a big market for these things. And, you know, it hasn't done very well either, right? So it's a difficult place to be. And then, you know...
Well, but at least the 747 can become a freighter, right? Whereas the A380 can't become a freighter.
Yeah, but that speaks to a broader philosophical point, you know, Airbus versus Boeing. Airbus, for whatever reason, has been much more hesitant with its freighter development, particularly on wide bodies, right? I mean, every Boeing wide body. And there's some discussion that even, you know, if Boeing were to choose to launch the NMA, that it might even be launched with one of the launch customers being an air freight company. That, you know, Boeing's just had a different strategy around freighters than Airbus over the years, right? Just a difference between the companies.
Sash, you were there, and we've talked a little bit about what the termination costs would be, including what write-downs and other stuff. You know, talk to us about what Airbus management had to say about the issue.
They've quantified the termination costs at around $500 million in cash terms over the next couple of years. Interestingly, they're a bit cagey about exactly how much those will be, and indeed, you know, whether there are other write-downs associated or costs associated with closing the program that they can't yet quantify. And I think the thing that is most interesting is the question of whether there is any remaining launch aid from the European governments that gets written off as a consequence of closing the program early. I don't think that Airbus will have covered all of the launch aid for the program, over 250-odd aircraft. If they did, then that would have been a tremendous achievement. But, you know, what this will do potentially is just add a little bit of fuel to the whole WTO fire with Boeing over, you know, was the A380 you know, heavily subsidized by European governments, and is that or should that have been illegal? I didn't think we're going to know that for some time. But I did detect a degree of imprecision in the Airbus statement about the costs of this that suggests to me that there might be a launch aid and hence a WTO angle that they're trying to find a way around at the moment.
Ron?
Yeah, it's a great point, Sasha. I mean, I would expect that the Boeing folks would be looking at that angle pretty carefully, right? Because over the years, I mean, that was the one of the big, as everybody knows, one of the big, you know, points of contention that Boeing's had around launch date. Interesting point. Something definitely to keep an eye on.
President declared a national emergency to build the border wall that he wants. $7.5 billion from appropriated but unobligated funding. About 3.6 would come from the Pentagon's military construction budget. About $2.5 billion would come from counter-terror, counter-interdiction, counter-drug programs. $600 million from the Treasury Department forfeiture fund, which is drug assets, that then and then the rest of it from other lines of the government. How did the announcement go over? Oh, and by the way, I should say, right, and there was $1.375 or whatever it is, $1 billion in fencing in the budget bill that the president signed. How was the response to all of this from Wall Street?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, when the news broke, it didn't really seem to impact the market at all. I had a couple of questions from clients, you know, what does this mean? I think my sense is, you know, investors are A, trying to just absorb what it means, and B, it would have been a big headline if it said something like, you know, Secretary Shanahan decides to cut, you know, the numbers of F-35s to build the wall, but that wasn't it. So, I mean, one of the areas where at least investors in the group of companies I look at, they don't really tend to focus much on military construction or those other accounts. So, you know, at this point so far, I think, you know, for Wall Street, from that perspective, it's been a bit of a yawn.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've got to go. Look forward to having you back on next week.
Yeah, glad to be here, Vago. Yeah, take care.
We're going to continue our conversation with Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London. But now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. Sash, let's go to U.S. And European defense, the Verkunde, the Munich Security Conference, universally known as the Verkunde Conference, takes place in Munich every year. And this year, there was a very, very stark clash between the United States. Mike Pence, the U.S. Vice President, was there, but Angela Merkel, I think, was speaking for a lot of the European nations, and leader after leader indicated ill ease with sort of what they consider to be U.S. Unilateralism. You've watched the relationship very, very closely. You watched the conference and listened to it very closely. What are some of the disturbing messages that you picked up?
I mean, it was in geopolitical terms. I mean, if it wasn't a train wreck, it wasn't far off. The relationship between the US and Europe, I can't remember it having been at a lower point. And to have a conference where the NATO allies effectively were split the whole damn time is very, very worrying. It just suggests that there is no agreement on the roles, the obligations, but also the benefits for all the parties of these transatlantic, very, very close political defense relationships. So Vice President Pence gave a poorly received speech, which talked a lot about the degree to which European nations have got to A, live with or, you know, cope with the US, current US policy, but also in particular back the US on Iran, Chinese cyber risks, and then spend a lot more on defense. That last, I think, will happen, but it's happening despite this, not because of it. I think that Europeans are beginning to realize they have to shape up on defense, because the US security commitment has never been weaker since 1945.
So what you're saying is that Europeans, right, supporters of the administration and some in the administration, who are neutral, point that the United States remains committed to NATO. They point to the European investment in European forces and capabilities as sort of a sign that this administration is doing more than the last administration. That's really not carrying any water with European leaders, is it? That we're spending more necessarily?
Absolutely not. I think that there are very, very small focused capabilities. Some of the recent exercises, in particularly Trident Juncture, have been really, really impressive. They have been all that is best about NATO in terms of the working together and showing commitment over a very, very wide range of capabilities at the high end of warfighting. But I think, if you look at what the US has in Europe today, and, I think the mudslinging between administrations is doesn't produce a valuable effect. But, the US, in terms of ground forces in Europe today, has got less than a division. Effectively, in combat terms, about one striker brigade combat team. There is an air defense capability, a whole batteries of Patriots, and they are sorely needed. And there are tactical aircraft. And then there is clearly the Fifth Fleet. But the ground capability that at one stage was 10 divisions with the promise of another 5 to 10 to come over the Atlantic under Reforger has just gone altogether. And as Europe starts to look at Russia, which is quite definitely resurgent on its borders, relying on the 7th Cavalry, let alone every other cavalry, to turn up, you just can't do that.
Despite all the strong rhetoric, and we've been listening to the rhetoric for some time, I mean, I think European governments do deserve a lot of credit for increasing their amount of defense spending rather substantially. I mean, the effective increase of sort of a British or French defense budget added annually to what the alliance spends. Is this disconnect between US and Europe going to, I mean, as you said, they're beginning to get the sense that they have to shape up. We've heard very, very strong statements from everywhere, from the Spanish government to the Italian government to the Dutch government to obviously Germany. Macron has talked about it. Are they really going to be able to do this in a concerted way? And then the second question is that the UK military capabilities have been equally key for the EU. Some of the senior most EU leaders always talk in glowing terms about the extraordinary British leadership and staff officers that are on all of these EU staffs, and that all of that would go away. So it's a two-part question. Are they finally going to get their act together? And can they get their act together if the UK is not in the EU ultimately, given that Britain is Europe's leading military power?
Short answers, no and no. I think that the idea that Europe will get its act together in a concerted way, that is still some way off. At the moment, what we're looking at are individual defense budgets going up, individual nations starting to rebuild capabilities that atrophied or were cut entirely 20, 30 years ago. I think the most interesting thing is going to be to watch when Germany commands the very high readiness NATO task force, which is a ground task force, initially of brigade strength, but then of divisional strength in the early 2020s. I think it starts about 2021. But that is seen already by Germany, militarily, politically, industrially, as being an opportunity to start coalescing European capabilities around a German lead. And incidentally, probably to sell German defense equipment as well. It's really impressive to see how Germany has got a defense industrial policy in some respects. We'll come back to the failures in a minute. But that is one example. As for the British capabilities, this is the problem. If you talk to the Brexiteers in Britain, they talk about the primacy of NATO. But the problem with the primacy of NATO is that if the US doesn't want to play, if the US does not believe in the, and by that, we have to mean the US government, then a commitment to NATO is not going to deliver European security. And it is clearly the case that the Brexiteers are incapable of accepting that there might have to be a European defense policy as opposed to a NATO defense policy.
And bring us up to speed then on our favorite topic, good Lord, which is the latest on Brexit. The deadline, March 29 deadline, is looming. There are increasing calls. There was a vote last week that didn't go well for the Prime Minister either. A lot of test votes, which just appear to be setting her back rather than moving her forward. Give us the latest on where we are, which I suspect is exactly where we were last week, which is where we were 6 weeks or 6 months or 2 years ago.
Okay, the optimists, of whom there are relatively few on the ground, would say that what is happening is that Theresa May is running down the clock. She is getting to a situation where there will be so little time left that the worries, fears about the impact of a hard Brexit mean that MPs finally vote for her Brexit solution, whether they like it or not, and they won't like it very much. That's the optimistic outcome. And last week played into that narrative. You know, another week wasted, votes went backwards, negotiations with the European Union are, you know, there's some talk, but there's nothing, nothing you would want to pin your money on at the moment. The concern is clearly that there may be a fantastic plan, but if the plan does not work, the only option on the table is the hard Brexit outcome. So if Parliament can't come to an agreement on what they want, March the 29th, midnight, hard Brexit occurs, because that is what has been passed into law already. It's nail-biting stuff.
Do you think Gavin Williamson, the Secretary of State for Defense, and the May administration have made clear that they're going to spend more money on defense. But all of that was supposing that the economy was remaining strong. But if you looked at the economic data from the end of the year, it was not encouraging in terms of a contraction in the British economy that was driven by Brexit uncertainty. At what point does that start to affect the defense bottom line? Because you can ride high when revenue is high. When revenue is not high, and there are a whole bunch of fundamental questions, whether about the solvency of the National Health Service or anything else, it makes it very, very hard to say, well, we're not going to be able to give you as much health care as you want, but here's another destroyer has a tendency of not sort of mollifying the public. Is there a connection, and at what point are we going to see a connection between economic performance and defense spending ambition?
The connection is tenuous for a couple of reasons. One is that ultimately defense spending becomes a distress purchase. You spend because you have to, nobody wants to spend on defense. What we're seeing elsewhere in Europe, further east and further north, is that defense budgets are going up, not because GDP is rising necessarily. I mean, European GDP growth is nothing to write home about at the moment, but because countries in Scandinavia, countries in Eastern Europe, and Germany recognize that there is an emergent threat to which there is no adequate response except to spend more on defense. Problem with that is that the UK does not feel that sense of threat and urgency at the moment to the same degree that countries north and east of us do, because we're about as far away from Russia as it's possible to be, with the exception of Spain and Portugal, and they ain't spending either. So yeah, you know, the economy is going to constrain defence. It is possible that one way that the UK copes with a hard Brexit is to do what governments have always done, which is basically to reinflate the economy, pour a huge amount of money into it. There will probably be some inflation. Sterling will be very weak. So you don't want to be a company selling defence equipment into the UK, because you're going to be killed by the weakness of sterling, frankly. I think this will do a lot of damage to programmes like the F-35. But on the other hand, programmes that are built in the UK will probably do okay. And, paradoxically, that's where ships come into it. The UK economy will have to undergo a degree of reflation, the same way that governments did actually after the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009.
How big do you think the impact on the F-35 program is going to be?
It's already been slowed down. I think the F-35 program will be limited to no more than 60 aircraft. That's enough for two aircraft carriers. Move on to Tempest. That's the easiest defense decision you can make to actually save money in the very early 2020s.
Do you think that it has an aggregate impact on the program as a whole, given the importance of British contractors on the effort? In terms of dollar sterling dynamics?
Look, the UK as a percentage of the F-35 offtake is immaterial. It's sub 5%. UK contractors supposedly are there because they were the best available at the time, and in some cases they have unique capabilities that cannot be transplanted, replicated elsewhere. We'll have to see.
Sash, what are you going to be looking forward to over the coming week? What are you going to be keeping your eye on?
Oh, look, we've still got results season coming out. I mean, MTU Aero Engines is going to give a really interesting look into the civil aircraft or civil aero engine aftermarket, and indeed how things are going on with the SCAF program, where they've you know, they've announced they're teaming with Snecfa. That's going to be, you know, a really interesting point to say this year.
And any earnings worth talking about in the last week? I was not keeping as good of an eye on it as I should have.
Yeah, Saab was very interesting. Now, Saab had a pretty torrid 2018. Their cash flow was really brutal up to the nine-month stage. They had a big cash outflow. They had a rights issue that was very poorly received. They raised 6 billion crowns in cash in the fourth quarter, but the share price is down 30-40% over the year. But the results themselves were good, and the confidence with which they talked about cash flow improving, the execution of the Gripen E program, the execution of the AC-26 submarine program, the execution of the GlobalEye airborne early warning program was taken really well by the market. Shares were up at one stage nearly 8% on the results. What's, I think, fascinating is that Saab is saying very clearly one of the reasons why they raised the money in this rights issue wasn't to cover, frankly, fairly lousy cash flow in the first 9 months. It was as the cost of getting into the UK-led Tempest combat aircraft program. The UK has made it very clear: you can come into our program, but you've got to be solvent. You've got to be strong enough to stay the course. Saab said, if that's what it takes, we do the rights issue now. And they were very clear that talks with the UK are going well. Talks with France and Germany on the rival SCAF program just aren't even moving.
Very impressive company, and what they've managed to do both on the new version of the Gripen, the A26, their critical role in helping Boeing win the TX program is just really admirable. Little engineering company. I mean, it's you know, it's a neat gang that are managing to do all these ambitious things, and that doesn't include radar. Yeah. Weapons, subsystems, undersea systems.
And what's so interesting is I think they want to do for Tempest what they did for for TX. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be. It really is one of those secret sauce companies. I mean, every company has incredible attributes and skills they bring to the table, but it is just neat to see such a small company have such an oversized footprint. Sash, thanks so very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Have a great week.
Thanks very much, Fargo.
And thanks to all of you for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report, that's at DefAero Report, and like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight. BellFlight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and until we're together again, have a great week.